This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Here at Marketplace, we've been focused on the debt limit discussions. I mean, it is a key beat over here. And with default diverted by a new budget agreement, we're entering an era now with caps on spending. Yet this is a time, if you look around you in so many parts of the country, where the need to address key problems is growing. I'm David Brancaccio with a special report, Finding Your Place, New Thinking for People with Nowhere to Live.
On any given night in the United States, more than 580,000 people are homeless.
I was able to start thinking about what I need to do without worrying about what's around me or who's going to hurt me.
When housing is scarce, it's not available, and it's very expensive. If you're vulnerable in any way, you're far more likely to experience homelessness.
When we talk about criminalizing people and dehumanizing people, and we say other citizens, housed folks who are in the community shouldn't have to see that, I think that that's a statement.
Let's look at ways of thinking about homelessness with the debt ceiling debate behind us and consider how more restrictive spending in Washington might affect these approaches. Let's take a look at the Biden administration's plan to end homelessness. Yes, that's the word they use, end. From Washington, here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer.
If you go through here, my messy closet.
59-year-old Joseph White is showing me around his one-bedroom apartment in downtown Washington.
I cleaned it up a little bit because I knew you were coming over. So I just wanted, okay.
His rent is subsidized by the federal government. He pays $300 a month. The apartment is mostly furnished with stuff other tenants were throwing out, which White found next to the building's dumpster. His couch.
That table, that desk, that printer, those lamps.
White learned to be extraordinarily resourceful before he moved in here 4 years ago because he was homeless. White is an Army veteran. He left the service in 1994 and got hooked on crack shortly after. White was only able to get clean after about 20 years after he had a roof over his head.
It helped me a lot because I was able to start thinking about what I need to do without worrying about what's around me or who's going to hurt me.
This is the premise behind the Biden administration's plan, a theory known as housing first. The idea is get an unhoused person housed, then tackle drug addiction, mental health, and other issues. Jeff Olivet is a big fan of housing first. He's executive director of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, a federal agency.
Hey, Jeff.
Hi.
Sitting down in a conference room just about a mile and a half from White's apartment, Olivet tells me on average it costs $10,000 a year to get an unhoused person into a permanent home. And
on any given night in the United States, more than 580,000 people are homeless.
Olivet says President Biden asked for more money in next year's budget to tackle the problem, but Congress would have to approve that.
I'm keenly aware of the political nature of how things get funded in Washington, D.C., and it's a complicated situation right now.
Olivet says charitable foundations and the private sector should pony up more money to help the homeless. So should cities and counties. But Sarah Hunter, director of the RAND Center on Housing and Homelessness in Los Angeles, says you need federal money on top of that to really make a dent in homelessness.
Every day, more and more people are falling into homelessness. So without new support, that will continue to occur, and it's bad for everyone.
Hunter is happy the Biden administration is paying closer attention to homelessness. The plan does provide teams of federal workers to help communities cut through red tape to access existing programs. But Hunter says
there's nothing really innovative or new about the plan
because that costs money. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
So, the administration's plan. Now let's hear from someone who's gathered the hard data. Greg Colburn is an assistant professor at the University of Washington's College of Built Environments and co-author, along with Clayton Page Aldrin, of the book Homelessness is a Housing Problem: How Structural Factors Explain U.S. Patterns. Let me go through a couple of possibilities for how many people explain what's happening with homelessness in America now. Substance abuse, is that the dominant driver?
There are probably three dominant narratives. I would say substance use is right at the top of the list. Poverty and mental illness are probably the other two. There's clear evidence that those factors and attributes increase the risk of experiencing homelessness at the individual level. But what we demonstrate in the book is that is not why our coastal cities have really, really high rates of homelessness.
You've gone through the data. You've gone through the data across the country. And what then would explain it?
Well, what we argue in the book is that access to affordable housing is the primary driver of homelessness. And in places like Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Boston, New York, Washington, D.C., access to housing is very, very limited, even with people with good incomes. And what happens then is when housing is scarce, it's not available and it's very expensive, if you're vulnerable in any way, you're poor, you've been discriminated against because of your race or ethnicity, you're physically disabled, you're mentally ill, you're far more likely to experience homelessness. And what we demonstrate in the book is that the reason Seattle has five times the per capita rate of homelessness of Chicago is not because we have more people with vulnerabilities. It's because our housing is really expensive and it's scarce.
Yeah, because when you talk about housing access, let's just be clear. You're talking about numbers of possible dwellings, but you're also very much talking about supply and demand. You're talking about how much it costs to find adequate housing.
That's exactly right. And one of the more interesting stories that we tell in the book is Detroit, Michigan, which is the most impoverished city in the United States, has far lower rates of homelessness than very affluent communities like Seattle and San Francisco. And the reason for that is that housing is relatively affordable in Detroit as compared to other places.
So, I mean, you've been confronting this data for a while now. I mean, where are you left in terms of the areas that are most ripe for making policy changes that would help this? Is it making it easier to build, relaxing zoning rules and other rules like that?
There's a couple levers that we could pull. One is certainly a regulatory lever, which is we need to think about our land use. And in many of our cities, we have to confront the fact that we've had relatively exclusionary land use in the sense that we've only allowed single family housing on many of the residential parcels in our cities. And that's going to have to change. Our cities are going to have to be denser. We're going to need to go up. We're going to have more people living on each parcel in order to accommodate all the people who are in these cities. We also have to confront the fact that there's a significant segment of the population who will not be able to afford market rate housing. As a society, to date, we've kind of said, well, that's tough. We're going to let the market figure this out because we have such a small program that provides housing to low-income households. And so we need to confront at the federal, state, and local level, how are we going to ensure that there's housing that people can access? And either that is giving people subsidies, or it is subsidizing housing that's affordable for people with lower incomes. And the scary thing about that is that's an expensive endeavor because housing is expensive to construct and it costs a lot every month. And so that's a reckoning that we as a nation are going to confront. And to date, we haven't done a very good job of that.
And research funded by the real estate site Zillow found that when communities are forced to spend more than 32% of their income on rent, homelessness goes up. As we just heard, there are many misconceptions about the drivers of homelessness. Substance abuse and mental health can increase the likelihood of becoming homeless. Let's hear now from people experiencing the precarity of not having a place to live. That's life for hundreds of thousands in this country who are disproportionately people of color. Addressing mental health and homelessness is a difficult funding process as well. Here's Marketplace's Kimberly Adams in Washington.
Advocates will quickly tell you the main cause of homelessness is the affordable housing shortage. And
people who have certain disabling conditions, mental health disabilities, substance use problems, are at higher risk of losing out in tight housing markets, so they are more likely to become homeless.
Dr. Margot Cushell runs the Benioff Homelessness and Housing Initiative at the University of California, San Francisco. She says without stable housing, managing mental illness becomes almost impossible.
The constant violence that people are exposed to, the lack of sleep, the stress and uncertainty, the humiliation, all of these worsen people's mental health.
And, says Cushell, homelessness limits their access to treatment. That's something Grace Lee sees walking the streets of Washington, D.C. for the nonprofit Pathways to Housing all the time.
So it's one thing if you and I have depression or bipolar or whatever, we just go to the doctor.
Lee helps people get signed up for Medicaid, food assistance, free phones, and housing.
When you're homeless, where do you go? What do you do?
One of her clients, Charles Gregg, has been experiencing homelessness in D.C. for almost 2 years. He says treating his PTSD and depression has gone on the back burner while he tries to get housing. But the stress of being homeless doesn't help his conditions.
Sometimes things happen that cause you to act other than you normally would, you know. And sometimes people say something or do something, and I just go totally south. And when I get excited sometimes, I talk real loud. Why are you screaming? And I don't do it on purpose, but it's just the way it comes out.
Pathways to Housing CEO Christy Respress says getting people into housing not only provides a foundation for treating mental illness.
Once people move into housing with the right support services, that actually their interaction with the legal systems go down. Their interactions with the ERs and the hospital emergency rooms, the psychiatric emergency rooms goes down.
And using those services, she says, is much more costly over time than providing people with a place to live and services to keep them there. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Advocates backing a policy approach known as Housing First, which my colleague Nancy explored earlier. It's the idea that people first need reliable homes before they can really improve their lives in other ways. Housing First was initially adopted during the George W. Bush administration. Some fiscal conservatives, for instance, liked the plan because it saved money down the road while also addressing homelessness. But there's now a growing pushback against this approach. Some places are trying to outlaw sleeping in unapproved locations. I spoke about this with Ann Oliva. She's CEO of the nonpartisan National Alliance to End Homelessness. Give me a sense of what you're seeing in several states about what you might term criminalizing homelessness.
So what we're seeing across the country is a rise in the number of people who are living unsheltered. And in fact, the number of people living unsheltered, that means on the streets or in their cars, has been going up every year since 2015. And part of the reaction to this increase in visible homelessness has been a move by sometimes state legislatures or local city councils or mayors to pass ordinances or pass state laws that make it harder for people to simply exist outside, even if they don't have a place to call home.
I've seen moves calling for bans on encampments where unsheltered people gather ad hoc. But then where do they go is the question that's left dangling.
That is always the question that's left dangling. Right now, we are in an unprecedented situation in terms of an affordable housing crisis. And moving to criminalize people simply for existing outside when they have nowhere else to go, what that does is it harms them. It harms the people who are experiencing homelessness personally for a variety of reasons. It also makes the jobs of service providers, which are already very difficult jobs on the front line, even more difficult because then they have to go track people down in other locations. And it also costs the system money. It makes the system less effective and less efficient. So there's a variety of reasons why we shouldn't be criminalizing people who are experiencing homelessness, yet it seems to be persisting.
Let's talk about some ideas out of the Cicero Institute, a think tank started by Joe Lonsdale, who's the co-founder of the very successful big data analytics firm Palantir. The Cicero Institute released a blueprint for how states can push laws to what it sees as reduce homelessness. It's not how you would prefer to go about doing things?
It is definitely not how we would prefer or really advise communities to address the issues of homelessness. And primarily because it, again, sort of dehumanizes people who are experiencing homelessness in really damaging ways, both to them and to the system. For example, it can be really damaging to young people because the effects can really follow them for a long time at a sort of crucial point in their development. And it's damaging for all people who are viewed as something that's less than worthy, less than human. And so what our approach is that we really are working with our political leaders and elected leaders to make sure that we're pushing for affordable housing, which is the thing that actually solves homelessness. Criminalizing somebody, arresting somebody, putting them in jail, or fining them is never going to solve their homelessness. But housing will. And behavioral health services that people want and need will. So we are really quite opposed to the way that the Cicero Institute and others who are like them are pushing forward on encampments that are really what they're saying is that we should be rounding people up and putting them into what I would call internment camps. And whenever we go down that road in this country, I think that we should all be cautious.
Yeah, I mean, the Cicero Institute describes it this way. States should direct funds away from expensive and ineffective Housing First programs toward short-term shelter and sanctioned police encampments, which you read in this other way.
Oh, I think I'm reading it exactly how they intend it. When we talk about, again, criminalizing people and dehumanizing people, and we say, you know, other citizens, housed folks who are in the community shouldn't have to see that, I think that that's a statement about how worthy we think folks are of resources and attention. And I think that those kinds of camps that they are suggesting, we know it doesn't work. We know it doesn't solve homelessness. What we know solves homelessness, that what the evidence tells us solves homelessness, is housing and services. And that's what we should be investing our long-term funding to develop additional housing and services to address the needs of people who are both at risk of homelessness and who are experiencing homelessness now. I think it's really easy and pretty lazy to say that because there are more people who are experiencing homelessness now than a few years ago, or unsheltered homelessness than a few years ago, that homeless policy or a housing first approach doesn't work. I often refer back to a colleague of mine, Dr. Margot Kuchel, who is saying that's like saying chemotherapy doesn't work because people still get cancer. It doesn't actually make sense, policy sense or financial sense.
But homeless people are still suffering, and people in places where homelessness is festering would be forgiven for wanting there to be some new thinking about doing something. I mean, affordable housing requires the long view, you know, it's zoning rules, changing public attitudes toward more development. That takes time.
It does take time. And that's why when we talk about what solutions need to be in place here at the Alliance, we often talk about what are the interim solutions that we can have in place while affordable housing is being built. And what do those look like? How do those meet the needs of people who are experiencing homelessness? So, for example, during the pandemic, a lot of communities stood up what we call non-congregate shelter in hotels. And the data and information that we've gleaned from that is that people did well in those programs in many, many communities and exited to housing at higher rates and were able to access services in those kinds of programs. So there is new thinking about how interim solutions can work while we are building the affordable housing system that we want and need. And we also have to push Congress to make sure that we're getting the investments that we need in both the affordable housing side and on the services side.
Thank you.
We reached the Cicero Institute for a comment. They told us, quote, decades of the same failed homelessness policies have resulted in an explosion of unsheltered homeless in our cities and an explosion of dollars being thrown at the problem with no accountability. The Cicero Institute says its policies, quote, help the vulnerable homeless get the shelter and treatment they need. Now to a paradox. Growing out of the strong U.S. labor market, many government agencies and nonprofits are having a hard time recruiting staff to help people get off streets and into stable housing. Here's our Matt Levin.
Leticia Rosales is covering the front desk at the Hope Cooperative's Outreach and Engagement Center in Sacramento. It provides 24/7 services to people experiencing homelessness. When we met, she was celebrating a permanent housing placement for someone who had been with the center for 117 days.
Yeah, it's like a graduation, you know what I mean? You see them start from their first step onto the next step.
Rosales makes about $22 an hour as an outreach worker. She was homeless as a kid and says this job makes her feel good, but it's not for everyone.
It's a high rate of turnover, but I feel like the ones that actually get it, like get the point of working with the people, are the ones that stay.
Finding the ones that stay is as tough as it's ever been, says Hope Cooperative CEO Erin Johansson. About 10% of her positions are basically always vacant.
We have a full-time recruiter. She spends all day every day trying to find us the right people.
There's really no good national statistics on the shortage of homelessness workers, but anyone in the field will tell you it's a problem. A study focused on LA County found that workforce needs to grow by 20%. And post-pandemic, one particular type of worker has been really hard to get.
A licensed clinical social worker.
People with master's degrees in social work, or MSWs for short, are trained to work with people with mental illness or substance abuse issues. Donna Gallup teaches in the MSW program at Azusa Pacific University.
Right now, there's tremendous competition for social workers, and there are much more lucrative and much more pleasant work settings.
Like schools and hospital systems, which typically offer better hours and less stress. While Gallup says higher pay for homelessness workers would obviously help, many of her students need more exposure and support. Gallup runs a pilot program that places master students with Southern California homelessness agencies.
They're entering a sector with their eyes open. Many people who do go into the sector go in and are very surprised, you know, disenfranchised, not understanding. Those are some of the reasons that people burn out.
Gallup says the early results of the pilot program are promising. While the official data isn't out yet, anecdotally, it looks like MSWs who participated are sticking with it. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Then there are the many unsheltered people who hold down jobs. A new study found 11% of California workers in the fast food industry are homeless, which reflects what we heard earlier from Greg Colburn. A lot of people have jobs and still don't have the resources to move out of extreme poverty. Reviewing the numbers from a report conducted by the nonprofit Economic Roundtable shows fast food employees make up, yes, 11% of all homeless workers in California and 9% in Los Angeles County. Here's the president of the Economic Roundtable, Daniel Flaming.
It's a large labor force. It's a lot of people with part-time hours and low wages and a hard time paying rent.
Is that the root cause of this? The fact that the pay, the compensation is low for this type of work?
Yes, the workers that we see when we go into a fast food restaurant, they work an average of about 26 hours a week. The cutoff point for being entitled to health care paid by the employer in California is 30 hours, and a full-time job is over 35 hours by most other definitions. So the employers, in most cases, don't have to pay health insurance for these workers, and that's a way of cutting private costs.
So keeping the hours lower in a given week so they're not counted as full-time employees, but the net effect is you need more people to do the work, but that means you're paying people less.
And it also means that the taxpayers are paying for health insurance coverage through Medicaid. So close to half of these workers get their health care through publicly funded insurance.
You can look at it through the other porthole here, which is housing's not affordable, and it makes those wages look low.
It's a double whammy, both expensive housing in cities like Los Angeles and also very low wages for these workers.
And tell me about some of the policies that would help align pay of fast food workers with what is needed to just get by and actually have a roof over your head. So it has something to do with minimum wage.
Raising the wage floor for the entire industry is one piece of the answer. Standards about scheduling, both number of hours and predictability of scheduling, are another piece of it. And we don't see a path toward achieving this without the public sector setting standards for the industry.
Right. In other words, some kind of government mandate for this. I mean, is there legislation pending?
There actually has been legislation approved. There was Assembly Bill 257 in California, which would have created this government oversight. And the fast food industry was able to get a referendum on next year's ballot on the law. So it's on hold right now.
A fast food industry group rejects these figures and called the report biased. The Economic Roundtable denies bias and called for fast food employers to release their payroll data to allow further analysis. Let's conclude the special report with that thing that we do here at Marketplace, doing the numbers, starting with a key number called the RTI that stands for the rent-to-income ratio. The government recommends that to be sustainable, rent should be less than 30% of what you earn. According to Moody's Analytics, using 2022 data, we've now hit this threshold. The national average rent is now 30% of income, the first time that's happened in the 20 years of these statistics. In New York, where homelessness is rampant, the rent-to-income ratio is 69%. In Miami, 42%. Los Angeles, 36%. And while other surveys show Americans want more affordable housing, they often don't want it near where they live. This Marketplace special, Finding Your Place, New Thinking for People with Nowhere to Live, was produced by Erica Soderstrom with help from Jarrett Dang. The key page online at marketplace.org was composed by digital intern Hannah Bagenstos. Our senior producer is Meredith Gerritsen-Morby. Our executive producer is Kelly Silvera. I'm David Brancaccio. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.